Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is a special Losar podcast titled We Can Make Miraculous Change.
Okay. Greetings, everybody. Losar Tashidele. Happy New Year of the Fire Monkey. We are today on the third day of that new year, which is always celebrated in Tibet, and sometimes on the same day in China, and in ancient time in Buddhist India and in Mongolia, because in those parts of the world, the springtime sort of begins around now in what's called the third, in the lunar month of this time. And this year is February 9th, the New Year's Day. And all of us in the circle of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which I wish it was the whole world, and especially the leaders of the world, we were all very cheered up and heartened by the fact that he sent out a New Year's message. And in his elder age, because of his love for his Tibetan people and because they're suffering so much, he did it in Tibetan. But he had someone of his assistants did a good job making captions in English. So there were, you know, it was translated as he went along. But I was following in my, what he calls my broken Tibetan. I followed him this time. He didn't have to use his, what he calls, broken English for our sake. So but I recommend everyone, you go to Dalai Lama's, dalailama.com website, and you can find this short video where he gives a little talk. And he's presently in the Mayo Clinic. He's been there for now for about 2 weeks, a little more, maybe 3 weeks, another maybe a week to go, doing some precautionary therapy to forestall perhaps some problem they have found in his prostate. And but only precautionary. He apparently does not have cancer, which we were very relieved to hear. And he looked well, and he looked fine. And he gave a thing. He did. I learned something completely new, though, in addition to about his better health, which was a great relief. I learned another thing that was completely new to me. All these years I've been saying Tashi Delek to people, and nowadays Tibetans use it as a hello, actually. And people who know about Tibet go, hello, Tashi Delek. But the two words Delek, I had never thought, why Delek? Dewa means happiness. Lekba means goodness. So why Tashi means good luck. So good luck, happiness, and goodness. But why Delek? Why is that part of the language? I never knew that. And he explained, in Buddhism, there's a way back in ancient Indian time, from the beginning, there are considered two kinds of things and aims that people should have. And one of them, of course, is nirvana and the highest good, you know, what we call the summum bonum. And the highest good is freedom from all suffering and enlightenment and nirvana and all this sort of thing. And that in Tibetan, it's called nishreyasa in Sanskrit, which is basically the summum bonum, highest good. And in Tibetan, it's called ngelek, the definite good. So that's the lek of delek, is the definite good. So when you wish someone tashi delek, the last word you use wishes them nirvana, Buddhahood, enlightenment, right there in the hello, you know. Hello, good luck, and get enlightened. Fully enlightened yourself, you know. I think that's marvelous. And then the dewa, happiness. Now, Buddhas are also quite happy. In fact, they're perfectly happy. But also, we do have worldly happiness. where when we are, you know, not suffering too badly, we're not too sick, we're not too old, we're not too hungry, we're not too painful, you know, we're not too distressed, you know. And there, so that's temporary happiness. And that's called abhyudaya, which means arisal, or ascendance, I like to translate it, like ascending, improvement, you know. So the deva, the happiness there is the happiness of improving our lives and having a better year. You know, at New Year's you say, deva, be happy, for have a happy year. We say, happy New Year. So that's the deva. And the leg, so deva and legba. Deva means have a happy time in the short run, in an ordinary sense. Well, a bit more ordinary sense. And then legba means you have a really happy time of becoming fully enlightened and a Buddha. So, for example, we shouldn't say if we wanted to follow the Tibetan, the Buddhist insight, Indian and Tibetan and Mongolian and whatever, we wouldn't just say Happy New Year. We would say Happy and Enlightened New Year. And by enlightened, we would mean becoming fully enlightened of Buddhahood, not just escape into nirvana in some dualistic idea of the nature of enlightenment, but rather become fully enlightened, be free of all suffering and all ignorance, and also expand your ability and your presence in the world to encompass all of it and to therefore be a compassion engine for all beings. So that's what the Buddha is. So enlightenment is more than just awakening from ignorance. It's also expanding and developing your ability to help others and effectively helping them to become free of suffering. So Tashi De Lek, that's the New Year's greeting. So now, in looking at and wishing you a Happy New Year, which is what I'm doing now, I'm harking back to a conversation, actually a debate I had with a friend not too long ago, where this friend is very gung-ho also, a great contributor to the Tibetan cause and the Dalai Lama, a very friendly person, happy person himself, pretty much a little bit worried person, like we all get when we think about reality of the way the world is. And he was saying that it's really important. He was accepting, in a way, what some scientists tell us about the fact that the global warming or global overheating or negative climate change, unsustainable climate change, has already gotten so bad and so intense that the ice caps, North and South Pole, are going down by the end of the century, no matter what we do. Even if we would turn off the Koch brothers, the coal-fired oil, power plants around the world in China and everywhere, in India, the oil power, the fossil fuel used everywhere, cars were all powered like Teslas on solar energy, etc. Even if we did all, and all cities and everything was powered that way, even if we did all of that, by 2100 of the common era, still the planet would be basically a wreck in all the temperate zones and the tropical zones. And there would be nothing to grow. No one could live in them. They'd all be dried out. And they flooded also Bangladesh, like would have disappeared. Florida would have disappeared. All kinds of island chains would have disappeared. We'd have 25, 30-foot sea level rise with Greenland and the North and South Pole melting. South Asia, Southeast Asia, and China would be devastated because, you know, especially the tropical parts of China, because the ice cap of the Tibetan plateau, the vast glacial ice cap there, would have melted and there would be no water in between monsoons. And heaven knows whether there'd be monsoons, because there'd be so many forest fires and the rainforest everywhere would be destroyed probably. So there was a picture, and one has a picture in mind of a planet with sort of brown, this devastation around the midriff of the planet, and then some green in place of ice caps up in the polar regions or the very northernmost regions, you know, British Columbia, Norway, Scandinavia, Siberia, and Patagonia, and maybe some of South Africa on that side. And maybe Antarctica itself, be beachfront. So some scientists say that because they have calculations that show that's possible, and it's not probably completely wrong, but in a way, what's the point of that prediction? In other words, you predict disastrous climate change to get people to change their behavior, and to the whole planet and the world leaders and industry and the wealthy, you know, and the oil industry and so forth, global oil industry and coal industry. And if you say it's no matter what happens, we're all doomed, or maybe only a third of us or half of us will survive, so we will hustle up in the north and make walls to keep people from the south coming there, or vice versa in the southern hemisphere. I mean, what kind of a future is that? You know, if we're 9 billion in a couple of decades, and then it's diminished to 4 billion or 3 billion, and 6 billion people have been doomed, plus all wildlife. I mean, that's hardly worth it. You know, if we can't keep more of our companions and more of our beautiful places, what's the point? You know, might as well die and be reborn on a cleaner planet. That is, if you're aware that you're going to be reborn, that's to say, you know, which many people on the planet are, actually. Most people on the planet, surprising to materialists, the majority of people on the planet are expecting to be reborn, in fact. So better to be reborn on a better planet, you know. Anyway, we had this debate, and my debate is really not completely rational, I have to confess, in the sense that I don't have a scientific prediction showing that if we did this and that and this technological intervention and completely shut down the fossil fuel thing very shortly within this decade and really severely constrained it to the barest minimum, learn to do without a lot of stuff and revert to intermediate technologies in a lot of ways. If we did all that, I don't have a study to show that then we could carry on with most of the people surviving, the birth rate naturally declining by educating women everywhere, which is the best population control method, having women be more free and not have to produce too many children, which they don't really want to do, actually, because it's a hard, huge job. And then when there's no livelihood much for the children because the population is too great in any area, then they naturally don't feel like it. And why should they be forced to by cultures that have not caught up with reality? So you know, if I don't have a study to show that that would all work. And by 2100, we'd be having a golden age of enlightened people and happy people because women would be equal to men. Everywhere, no exceptions, no traditional quote-unquote patriarchies left. The patriarch is realizing that they were, you know, timed. They were a timed phenomenon, and they ran out of time. And now we have an equal partnership, what the great Rihanna Eisler calls the partnership society, where men and women share decision-making, share power, share authority, share skills, share contributions, etc., share everything equally. And so I don't have a thing to show that that would actually radically reduce rather than come up with a scenario where it's relatively hopeless or even totally hopeless, you know. So I don't. But I believe in the power of the enlightened beings in the universe, which are not just the one Buddha on this planet 2,500 years ago or the one Jesus or the one Muhammad, or the one Krishna, or the one Yajnavalkya, or the one Confucius, or Lao Tzu, or whoever it is, the great teacher of Socrates, and Pythagoras, you know, the great teachers of humanity. It isn't just these one. The enlightened beings are, you know, like people in Star Trek, you know. They have federations in other galaxies. They're all over the place. They have learned to mind transport, you know, to teleport by mind. They don't have to have big, heavy metal spaceships and so forth, and burning a lot of rocket fuel or whatever. They are able to levitate. They're able to fly. It makes sense to me, given infinity, beginningless infinity, and how enlightened beings are defined and how the human being is close to that enlightenment and capable of achieving it. And since you have an infinite past, there have been infinite planets with infinite number of human beings. If you want to look at materialist notion of cosmology, there have been infinite big bangs and big crunches and whole universes emanated between there. not to mention going into like multiverse and the idea that there are parallel universes right now in different dimensions and so on, like there's, you know, the string theorists and all these theoretical people get into. This is ancient Buddhist view. And this is ancient, and many other traditions in Asia had this view that there are aliens, and the good ones are the more powerful ones, and the bad ones are, you know, much less lower tech and lower ability, so therefore one doesn't have to be frightened of them. And they are there, and there are these methods, and we can become enlightened, and once we become enlightened, there's magic, what we would consider magic. We would consider it magic as materialists, where the only magic we believe in is computers and TVs and airplanes and things like that, which other people in other cultures might have thought of magic, that kind of level of intervention with materiality. But in ancient time, there's another kind of magic of mind over matter and mind transference and mind transmission and mind transportation. And these things are considered commonplace, actually, and they're not the purpose of enlightenment. The purpose of enlightenment is the magic of freeing beings and ourselves, self and other, from suffering, you know, completely and totally. But that's an infinite job because they're infinite beings. There's an infinite universe in time and space, eternal and infinite in time and space, and therefore it's an infinite job. So it isn't that, you know, it's all done already, and becoming enlightened and free of suffering doesn't mean becoming annihilated at all. There's different blissful environments in which to spend time and to enjoy, and to enjoy an interaction and so forth. It isn't a matter of just one goes all alone somewhere into a vast space or something, as some people wrongly have a view that enlightenment is like that. Not that such an experience is not a valuable experience, but that's not the final destination, actually. That's just a kind of touching on the magicality and the ephemerality and the transmutability of the relative reality is getting a notion of the ultimate reality as vast freedom, you know, vast negation, let's call it. But you don't stick in that vast negation, because once there is such a vast negation, it becomes utterly affirmative of a positive relativity. So in my argument with my friend, I was saying if according to some material, you know, predictions based on computer models and whatever it might be in mathematics, which is all really valuable, I don't put it down. But if there's a worst case analysis like that, then it's incumbent upon us to seek the passing of miracles. We must work for miracles. We must make them ourselves. We must be miracles ourselves, or what would be called miracles. We must accept the reality that anything is possible, given the vast infinite power of the vacuum, the infinite power of voidness, the clear light of the void, the transparency of the void. Given that, we must seek that ourselves. World peace through inner peace. Inner peace must not just be a withdrawal from the worry about the world. It must be a powerful state in which we speak to the world and get the world to radically change behavior. That's what must be done. We must not concede at all. It's good to have a material thing that shows that the way that we're going is driving things down the drain. That's really important. And actually, if we can take a moment in the new year to look at the horror of everything on this planet today, it is horrible. The only, you know, look at America. We used to have a democracy. Read the book Dark Money and they realize that there are those who are subverting democracy, and I don't mean Republicans. Republicans are still players and participants in democracy. They happen to be the conservative. They used to be the conservative ones. Actually, in Lincoln's time, they freed the slaves. In Jefferson's time, they tried to be nice to the Indians, and they tried to free slaves. And Republicans are a good part of democracy. They're just one pole of it. But the Republicans have been captured by anarchists, by moneyed libertarians, which means anarchists. And those libertarians are not true libertarians because they run their own households and their own corporations like fascists, brooking no opposition, no debate. They know everything, and they have all power over everybody, life and death, actually, in their corporations, which is what they would do when they have destroyed our democratic government, where other people have a say. And that's what's happened now. The Republican Party has been captured and paralyzed, and has been for 8 years now unable to participate and to govern and to participate in government, because they've been captured by these moneyed interests under fake banner of populism, and they are paralyzed. And they want, of course, to finish the job and paralyze the entire government permanently, destroy the social system, and have it completely at their beck and call, which means look out, ordinary people. And most people, of course, don't understand that. You have to read the wonderful, you know, heroic book by the great heroine of Jane Mayer, you know, the heroine journalist called Jane Mayer, who is speaking truth to power in the awesome way of her book Dark Money, which I recommend to everyone. And then since we are supposedly the bastion of democracy, although I think the European Union countries are ahead of us and we've fallen behind, after they had a terrible world war, they became more democratic than us. And even our enemies in the world war, we pushed on them the ideal of democracy that we're not living up to, because we became corrupted first by militarism and then now, amazingly, by anarchism. Omnipotent, infantile anarchism, which is really, really dangerous to the world. But anyway, therefore, we are in a way giving up. We've lost democracy. And we are captured by the fossil fuel industry, who are bent on their power and money, and they're ignoring the scientific predictions, and therefore there's no way to get the Chinese, the Russians, or the Indians, the Muslim populations, the Latino people to follow an example that is no longer there. So horror is a horror. We're looking at a really tough world. We really have to be activists in that world in a happy way, in a miraculous way, in a way where we're facing death and accepting we could be die at any time, and we don't become terrified and angry and furious and bring death and rain death upon others because of our fear. We do not allow ourselves to be terrified, and that we act totally positively. But we face the grim reality very, very, and are free of fear of it, actually. Just grit your teeth and you're gone, and then you'd be reborn in a better place. You know, be reborn on that moon that James Cameron made for us in Avatar, or any other such world. I don't know if it's in this solar system and the second moon of Jupiter, but there's an Avatar world for sure, with those beautiful plants and marvelous, marvelous horses and fabulous bodies with the tails living in tree houses. A wonderful, fabulous thing. So sci-fi opens our imagination to the miraculous, and shouldn't be despised and ignored by enlightened people by any means. So now we come to miracles. Now, in the New Year's, the Tibetan people and the Mongolian people, for centuries, have celebrated this Lunar New Year in the spring, which is springtime, considered springtime by them, celebrate 2 weeks, the fortnight of miracles, that Shakyamuni Buddha performed in ancient India in the city of Shravasti near the great in the Kosala kingdom, and in which time all the major city-states of northern India at that time, because it wasn't a single government, but all the major city-states, kings, and populations were present in a huge group of people. And he performed 2 weeks of miracles, according to the story that believed by Tibetans and Mongolians and ancient Indians, Buddhist Indians, 1,000 years ago when Buddhism still existed in India. And it's marvelous. And there's a wonderful poem by the Panchen Lama, the first Panchen Lama or the fourth Panchen Lama, who lived in the 17th century and helped create the institution of the Dalai Lamas. And fifth Dalai Lama was his disciple, and then the previous four incarnations were named Dalai Lamas by him and so on. And he has a great poem about it, and he honors Shakyamuni, a Buddha, and he says, "I bow down to him, he who, having purified by the fire of wisdom and soothed by truthful worlds, the argument between the king and his brother," that's King Prasenajit, of course, Allah performed in Shravasti many miraculous actions. And then the first one, which is that's the one that my family have always celebrated as the Christmas tree miracle. I bow down to him who planted in the earth a toothpick, which, growing into a wish-fulfilling gem tree, satisfied all desires of humans and gods when pre-King Prasenajit made offerings on the first day of spring. So that celebrated 3 days ago, that particular miracle, where he took a toothpick after ceremonially tasting a piece of fruit or something at the beginning of that day's 2 weeks. It was basically 2 weeks of miracles. He'd been challenged by six pretentious teachers who had 90,000 disciples and were sort of the orthodoxy of the time and pretending that they knew what reality was and what people, how people should live and what they should do. But actually, they didn't really know. They were just pretending, but they were jealous of the Buddha. So they challenged him to miracles. And this he kept running away from these challenges. He didn't like to do miracles. But then finally, he accepted in order to encourage the people of India at the time and to encourage us that the miraculous is possible. And so these 2 weeks are always, we celebrate, Tibetans celebrated since 1409, they started officially to do it, as founded by the great Tsongkhapa in Lhasa with the Great Prayer Festival, as it's called. And everybody took 2 weeks off of work, actually, where they took 2 weeks off of work and they just prayed and meditated and had a retreat for 2 weeks. They just ground the wheels of industry and agriculture and whatever it is to a halt and thought about the Ngelekpa of Delek, you know, the highest good that they really, that the human life is all about, because we have access to it. And since everyone always thinks that regular reality means you have to slave away whatever it is that you do, the miraculous is to do something different, you know, and really reach for a higher, beautiful, more beautiful thing. So that was the first day. And then the second day, I bow down to him who, to the right and left of his throne, created, teaching throne, created great jewel mountains covered with excellent food and sweet grasses. When worship, when made offerings by Udayana, who was the king of another kingdom, on the second day, that would have been yesterday. And these were huge mountains he created on two sides of where he was on a great plain in front of the city of Shravasti. And then I bowed down to him third day, and that's today, who on the third day rinsed his mouth after being offered food by King Shunzin and created a lake of eight wondrous attributes on which bloomed lotuses of laughing, radiant light. So he created a lotus lake in front of himself, a pond. So now you have the jewel tree, giant jewel tree behind. You have two jeweled mountains on either side, and you have a lake in front of you. And this is on the third day that the Buddha is doing that. And then he manifested. Then I bow down to him on the fourth day. That's tomorrow. When offered midday food by Indravarma, the Buddhist monks only eat at the midday, one meal a day. And Indravarma is from another one of the city states. I'm not sure which one. Manifested a pond from which eight streams rippled in a circular path, showing or teaching with their sounds, their gurgling sounds, the teachings of the three vehicles of the Holy Dharma, that is the vehicle of the monastics, of the monks and nuns to attain personal liberation, the vehicle of the bodhisattvas to attain liberation and freedom from suffering for all beings in addition to themselves, which is not against that of the monks. It builds upon the vehicle of the monks and nuns, and then finally the vehicle of the Vajra, of the adamantine love and compassion, the mystical, magical vehicle of the Tantra. And so these were taught by the actual gurgling water of the circling streams, the pond that he had, which I don't know how that relates to the lake, actually. I don't know, we have to do a painting of this to figure it out. I bow down to him, so that's on the tomorrow, you know. And then on the fifth day, Brahmadatta, who was the king of Benares, Varanasi, he made offerings. And then the Buddha at that time radiated from his smiling face a golden light which filled the 3,000 world universe. Actually, it's not really 3,000. I translated this ancient, you know, 50 years ago, but it's the 3,000 great thousand world, which is 3 billion. You know, 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000, which is a billion, which is 3 billion worlds. And this means 3 billion universes or galaxies or something. You can't really tell. It purified those in the lower states and filled all beings with the joy of samadhi. That is, it made everyone feel blissful as one can feel in a kind of high trance state, high meditative state of pure bliss. And this golden light flowed everywhere from his smile. And, you know, because that kind of what they call supreme emanation body Buddha is the actual embodiment. The embodiment of such a Buddha is itself a miracle, actually, in the Buddhist view. That is to say, the way the Buddhists understand evolution, Buddhist biology, the human being, the animal being, even an insect, even a microbe, if it's a living being, a being with consciousness, can become this extraordinary creature called a Buddha that has the ability to, that it feels the unity with all beings in the whole universe, actually physically experiences it, mentally and physically experiences it, and has a kind of magical ability, therefore, since sort of consciously unifies with all the energies, subatomic energies of the universe, and all the atoms and all the plants and all the mountains and all the galaxies, can shape all of that energy, the ultimate infinite energy of the vacuum, or the infinite energy of the void, as they would put it, which they call the transparent clear light of the void, and they can shape anything that beings need. They are, and therefore, when they shape themselves as a humanoid being that starts out as an ordinary king or prince, and then becomes an enlightened being, that is to say, some sort of otherworldly entity like V'ger in Star Trek, you know, like the combination of a supercomputer and a human being that can then benefit all other beings. This is evolutionarily possible. Every one of us can do it. We don't need a kind of robot like Ray Kurzweil promises everybody in 2045, made of metal or biological substances. We become ourselves as a sentient being, this infinite being that can manifest many kinds of embodiments to benefit other, which we would only bother to do because the whole universe feels like bliss to us at that time, super bliss to us at that time, but we bother to do it to help others, to enfold them in that kind of super bliss. It's really a wonderful idea. So anyway, from that smile, he filled the world with golden light and made everyone feel wonderful. And then I bow to him who, when offered food by the Lichavi, these were the people who lived in Vaishali, the city of Vimalakirti, generated faith and belief in those assembled, I love this one, and mindfulness in those assembled, by enabling them to read one another's minds and see the white and black thoughts of themselves and others, the good and bad thoughts of themselves and others. That is to say, in this vast crowd, everybody suddenly became clairvoyant about the others. And they could hear, they realized that their own thoughts were being read by others, so they really focused mindfully on having only positive thoughts. They didn't want to have negative, grumbly, grimy, angry, and hypocritical thoughts, because others could read them. I think that was a really cool one. And after each miracle, by the way, in this story, in these 2 weeks, the Buddha then gave a teaching, you know, like a teaching of selflessness, teaching of emptiness, teaching of sympathetic joy, teachings of love, infinite love, teaching of compassion, you know, whatever it was, you know, it doesn't specify. These are just mentioning the miracles. The miracles were just to get people's attention, you know. And then the next one, I bow down to him who transformed each of those assembled in the field of virtue into a world sovereign, that is an emperor, made them feel like kings, having 7 magical jewels. When the Shakyas, that was because his father was one of the Shakyas, and his father was always upset that Buddha didn't become an emperor himself and conquer the world in a political way, social, political, military way, because the father was a king, you know, and a general himself of the Shakyas, you know, the Shakya kingdom. But the Buddha then sort of showed everyone was a king, you know. He showed that to his father. That was particularly for him that day on the end of the first week. So that's the 7th day. Then on the 8th day, he unfortunately did one thing that we might think of as negative, but he had Vajrapani, who was like a kind of fierce deity, jumped out of his throne, you know, jumped out from behind or beneath Buddha's throne, and chased away the 6 false teachers who were capturing people's minds with various dogmatic authority, orthodoxies and imprisoning them from really perceiving and getting a realistic worldview about the infinity of causation and their infinite opportunity to become infinitely enlightened themselves, not just sit around worshiping some teacher and some guru. So he kind of chased away the fake gurus. And that's a little too bad. I always regretted he didn't keep those fake gurus and get them to join in the study that of everybody in these 2 weeks. But somehow they have a kind of note of realism there where he kind of chased them away. And in a way, the 90,000 followers of those six fake gurus had to see their gurus kind of chastened and humbled as they had been challenging the Buddha and jealous of him and saying all kinds of bad things about him for so many, many years, in order to feel free that now they should think for themselves. So let's say he had them disappear and then he brings them back later and teaches them later, doesn't let go of them, the Buddha. Because otherwise that's something negative. We don't want that. I bow down to him. Then I bow down on the ninth day when offerings magically manifested from the gods, not from any human king. And he expanded his physical shape, his form, his body, so huge that it reached up to the highest heaven, and the lower part of his body descended beneath the earth down into the lowest hells in the Buddhist worldview. So in a way, he showed how he was unified in a visual, like in a visual happening, a special happening, artistic event. He showed that he was just as vast as the universe. I bow down to him. Then on the tenth day, whose body shone 1,000 rays of light, reaching the height of the world, they formed a brilliant cloud from which benefits and happiness rained upon all beings. So that one, you know, was like Santa Claus. A certain group of gods called the guardians of the directions in Indian lore made offerings on that day. One of them is actually the Buddhist Santa Claus, who lives near the North Pole, Vaishravana. And his name is Vaishravana. And he's very much honored in China and Japan, Korea, as well as in Tibet and Mongolia and in ancient India. And then everyone was rained all, you know, wish fulfilling, whatever they needed. Eliminating all poverty from the world for the time being. Then on the 11th day, I bowed to him who sat on his lion throne, his teaching throne, without being visible. So there was nobody sitting there, just light on the throne. He was invisible at that time. And yet from that invisible rainbow light, the teaching emerged with the voice of the goddess Saraswati. And Saraswati is the goddess of wisdom, like Manjushri is the deity, the male god of wisdom. Saraswati is the goddess of wisdom. And stream of inspiration, her name means, and she has a particularly beautiful and melodious voice. So that voice emerged from the light that was where the Buddha was sitting, with invisibly, that's the 11th day. Yes, then on the 12th day, he sat in the meditation of love, metta, you know, like our dear Sharon Salzberg is always doing, of real love, universal love. I can't wait for her next book to come out. And he sat in the meditation of love and filled the 3,000 worlds with golden light, causing all beings to love each other as parents their children. On the 12th day, when he was given offerings by a particular householder. These are lay people giving him offerings on those 2 days, 11th and 12th. And that's a true thing. They say that when you really master the immeasurable love meditation, the dhyana realm, you know, the meditative realm, the Zen realm of immeasurable love, when you master that, you do radiate a kind of golden light, they say. And that golden light, when any animal even perceives it, they become loving. It just fills them with love. It's a vibrational, it's like morphic resonance from a consciously resonated by a meditator, from a meditative state. In a way, it's not that you're creating that out of ether. By entering into, that's a plane in the world as it is, actually. The world has that flow of love at a deep energy level. And when you reach it in meditation, you become a channel for it. And it goes all around. And so the Buddha does it in such a huge power that this, again, golden light flooded the whole universe, the billion world galactic universe. And everyone in that universe for some time while he was in that state on that day, the 13th day, I guess, that was on the 12th day. They just felt loving, and they just thought everyone else looked to them like their beloved own child. So there's one famous story about when the Buddha was attacked by a rat elephant, sent after him, released after him by his evil half-brother and a king who was in his thrall, in order to destroy him out of jealousy. And that when the elephant, however, saw Buddha, he just felt loving in a peaceful way, not loving in a violent way, but in a peaceful way. It just knelt down. The Buddha knelt down in front. I mean, the elephant knelt down with him, and everybody was shocked because this elephant had been tearing up the town. So then, now the 13th day. Now this is the one where the Buddha's father was really, and everybody was very flipped out. I bow down to him. Panchen Lama writes, from whose navel two rays of light rose 7 arm spans high, on the points of which were Buddhas, replicas of himself. And from their navels came forth light, and from there with two rays of light, and then there were 2 Buddhas on that, and then from there 2 Buddhas on that. And pretty soon, all of the directions of the world were filled with subatomic Buddhas, with atomic-like atoms of Buddhas. So everything was made of Buddhas. Everybody saw Buddhas in every atom, but felt them in their own body, like their own body was made of little tiny atomic Buddhas. And subatomic Buddha energies, they suddenly felt that. That was on the 13th day. That's 13 is a lucky number in Buddhism, actually, a very lucky number. And that's the 13th day. I wonder if that's the source of it. And finally, on the 14th day, I don't know why, he created 1,250 jeweled carriages. Jewel Teslas, or jewel carriages, when a king called Udayana, who strew clouds of flower petals all over, and he turned those flower petals into 1,250 jewel carriages. I guess the idea being showing to beings in the vast host of beings from at least 6, if not more, city-states around North India at the time, like the city-state Athens, Sparta, Corinth, all of the Thessalonica, all the different Greek ones. India was like that, a matter of city-states. And some of them very much more wealthy and powerful than Greece, of course, because of the huge agricultural size of the Indian river valleys, so big, much bigger than Egypt, India, or than Mesopotamia, actually. Anyway, so the jewel carriages symbolize that you can get in some vehicle, like the universal vehicle of love and compassion of the Bodhisattva, the individual vehicle of wisdom and freedom of the monastic, and the esoteric and apocalyptic vehicle of the yogi and the siddha. And you can, and so he showed all these, you made that there were carriages and there were vehicles, ways in which you can proceed to a higher state of being, to a better life, to a better world. Miraculous things are there, And finally, at the end, I bow down to him who, when Bimbisara, who was the king of Magadha, and who was a great, great friend and supporter of the Buddha, born on the same day, actually, as the Buddha was born, and satisfied all with the ambrosia of the gods, the Buddha that day. So everyone suddenly had, cups of exquisite, drink that was like ambrosia, that like elixir, and sent forth purifying golden rays from his fingertips that brought happiness to beings even in the lowest hells. So he suspended all the hell states in that last miracle on the 15th day. And traditionally in Tibet on the 15th day, His Holiness the Dalai Lama would give blessings and gives a teaching. And since the exile started in 1959, and since he moved to Dharamsala in 1960, he has held a teaching where he gives teachings on the former lives of the Buddha as a bodhisattva, when he was a great king who gave away his kingdom, or he gave away his own life to somebody in different form. When he was a monkey king and gave his life to save the monkeys, when he was a deer king and gave his life to save the herd of deer, etc. All these former life stories, he will pick a few of them and give wonderful discourses. And the 13th Dalai Lama did it, and the Dalai Lamas did that since 1409, approximately. They would do that on the 15th day, on the day when the Buddha gave the light that sent out the light that even freed the beings from suffering, even in hell. And, of course, Buddhists do have an idea of hell. Believe me, they do. And But they have no idea of eternal hell. They would never agree with that. There's no such eternal hell. The only eternal thing is Buddhahood. When you become fully enlightened, then you're eternally blissful. But, you know, there's too much. The goodness of the universe is way too powerful. And the nature of the universe is that for there ever to be an eternal one. But beings can behave stupidly and harmfully and destructively, and they can hurt each other and hurt themselves and be destructive to themselves. And in that way, they can create a hell. Just like right now, this industrial, militarist, consumerist, and ideologically extremist culture that we live in is creating a hell out of a beautiful planet. We are creating a hell here ourselves. I mean, the scientists will tell you, you know. And unfortunately, they are involved in the process because although they are clever in measuring material reality, their ultimate worldview and the fact that they live in denial of the existence of their mind and spirit and of the power of spirituality and ethics and the power of the mind, what they would consider miraculous, the power of the mind, but which in more ancient traditions are considered normal when people really develop their minds. So in a way, the scientists are somewhat also responsible. The technologies that their discoveries have made. They did nothing wrong in trying to discover how things work. That is, in fact, really good. But by making a dogma out of materialism and by making a dogmatic refusal about spirituality based on, of course, trying to escape from torture chambers of a negative form of extremist theism, of course, which I applaud them for doing, I have to say. You know, extremist theism, there is nice forms of theism, but there are extremist forms, just as there are nice forms of non-theism and there are extremist forms of non-theism. You know, human beings can make almost any, even the best idea into something extremist if they misinterpret it and they don't think about it carefully enough and they don't measure it against their own personal experience the way the Buddha insisted that we should do, not just accept dogmas from people, including not from him. So of course, therefore, it's possible for us to make temporary, very negative things. But believe me, even if we didn't have miraculously powerful Star Trek level Dr. Spock type of beings, you know, beaming in to help us not turn this planet into a wasteland at this time, if we didn't have that, we're on our way to doing it, actually. And in a way, why are they allowing us even to do that? If they're so powerful, you might ask in a debate, why are they allowing us to do that? Well, because we have a great deal of freedom, but also somehow by realizing our destructive power, this has brought us up to the place where we are being forced to realize we have to take responsibility for our destructive power in a way. You know, like material science has enabled us to have nuclear weapons and hydrogen fusion and fission weapons and hydrogen bombs. And of course, we could release the ones we built stupidly based on being in bad moods and fear and hatred and anger. We and our Russian friends who are just teammates, you know, like the Russians, they could have a Super Bowl team. They're just like us. Russians are a bunch of Yankees like we are. They just speak a much more complicated language with a different alphabet. And they've been mean to their Indians like we were genocidal to our Indians. They rampaged all over Asia being mean to everybody. But they also can be very good, just like we can. So anyway, we've created this thing, and now, and believe me, anybody who gets into the place where they have the buttons to press, where they can launch these things, and even as irresponsible and egotistical and arrogant and silly as they might have been before, and they still might be in some ways, They definitely don't press those buttons. It's been a miracle that since 1945, nobody's pressed one of those buttons. And of course, many of the people who've had the buttons in their hands have not been that kind of sort of ethical and moral giants, you could say. So the miraculous has, I mean, the miraculous, the miracles around us are right there if you take a look at it, if you look for it. Anyway, that's my Losar Tashi Delek talk. I think I'm a little bit longer than usual, my podcast. But it is New Year's, and you should be on retreat. You shouldn't be working day and night. You should be on retreat. And I'm actually working day and night, but in something I enjoy, the sublime continuum of the jewel gene of the Buddhahood, written by the future Buddha by miracle channeling in the 5th century of the Common Era, or the 4th century of the Common Era, late 4th century of the Common Era. And so that's not work for me, but it's just time-consuming. And so last thing I want to say is you can join us at celebrating this, not like the two-week celebration they do in Lhasa and will someday in the future again do in Lhasa, but just the one day at Carnegie Hall on February 22nd, 2016, where we will be there with a bunch of great artists and generous, kind, and helpful people who really realize that the Tibetan people are part of the fabric of our own lives and their misery and suffering and unhappiness, just like the Chinese people's misery and sufferings and unhappiness, or the Indian people, or the Southeast Asian people, or the Native American people, or the American black people, or the African people, or the Latin American people. We're all interwoven in one great body of life. And our particular focus, because we are thinking of the miraculous 2 weeks in relation to the glorious jewel of Tibetan culture that Tibet House U.S. and the Tibet House Network worldwide, is mission is to preserve. And so therefore, we have one day, one night, we have Philip Glass pulls together these great artists, and then we have rock and rollers, and we have ethnic artists, and we have really wonderful, good vibe in that, you know, and Shakyamuni's golden light from his fingertips must infiltrate Carnegie Hall on that day. So come join us and come to our gala dinner, you know. Although that's fundraising, so that's a little expensive. But the tickets are reasonable for the Carnegie Hall. And we look forward to seeing everyone there. And maybe someday we'll live stream it, but we've never been able to afford to do that. So people could be there much more than can fit into the hall. But anyway, that's our little tiny fragment keeping alive of this 2 weeks of miracles that I just read you about and talked to you about. And believe me, we're going to have miracles this century. And we don't have to get a big deal just because from 2000 to 2015, there's a bunch of bad behavior going on. And there's a few fanatics running around doing horrible things to each other and suffering badly themselves, because it doesn't make anybody happy to do horrible things. Absolutely not. They don't enjoy it. They can shout and scream, and they're just more miserable by being mean to anybody. And but we can start now. I mean, you know, you can start the century of the golden century right now, anytime, and it'd be your golden century. And then once you start it, we have a political revolution with the old Bernie. We have an ethical revolution with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We have a spiritual revolution with all the great world religious leaders of all the different religions and countries, and the spiritual secular humanists, which is a world religion. They have a revolution, led by Sam Harris or whatever, whoever it is, an ethical revolution of secular ethics. And we can make miraculous change, and we will make miraculous change, and the planet will be better than ever in another few years. So here's to you. Cheers. Tashi Delek. Happy New Year.